Acquisition number 12519, Reel 2.
Vice Marshal McGill, Reel 2.
Yes, at that time the South African fighters were very active indeed on our behalf. But prior, there's one point that might be of interest, and that is that immediately prior to the main battle of Kerin, we aircrew were all called in and were given a sand table briefing by the army as to what they were going to do, and it was excellent, very well done indeed. And the main spokesman at this briefing was a brigadier called Slim. Little did we realise what a name he'd make for himself later on, because, after all, Field Marshal Slim.
What impression did he make?
Excellent. Absolutely excellent.
In what sense?
Clearly a fighting soldier. Clearly well aware of well briefed and fully conscious of the nature of the problem they had at hand, and was very clear and suggesting or asking really what sort of support he could expect from us. And there's no doubt about it that he gave every impression of being a chap who was determined to do the job, and he clearly, his whole approach invited full cooperation. No question about that. One knew that chap was leading an excellent show and gave people incentive to support him.
Were you operating in Abyssinia and Eritrea right up to the collapse of the...
No, I wasn't. I was pretty well... I was overdue for the expiry of my tour in the Sudan before that, in fact, and I was invited to stay on for a little while I commanded the squadron at the latter end of my service with it. So almost immediately after Kerin fell, I was posted back up to Cairo. So I didn't see the show through to the end, to Ambrolagia and places like that.
I think that was in April 41 that you went to headquarters RAF Middle East.
That's right, in Cairo.
What did you do there?
I had a routine staff job on the operations staff, but there was one interlude that I think I've mentioned, that near the, I've forgotten when it was, in the latter part of the year, it was after the withdrawals from Greece and Crete. There was an army, the army were preparing to push through the Western Desert again. And then the then commander-in-chief of the Air Forces in the Middle East, the great man Tedder, decided that he would send an army, an Air Force officer to each division and in the Western Desert. Not surprisingly, I was told to go to the New Zealand division, presumably because I spoke the language. But there was a South African colleague of mine who also went to the South African division. So there I found myself on the staff of Tiny Freyberg, heading up the 2nd New Zealand division. It was Tedder's idea was that the generals should have somebody with them to advise, if you like, on targetry and that sort of thing, but also to impress upon not only the general, he already knew, but other members of the division, that sort of thing, that there were air forces about, and we were in a much stronger position than there had been previously in Greece and Crete, where sadly, of course, the chaps on the ground saw very little of the air forces. They were busily trying to win the battle elsewhere. So it was something of a PR exercise as well as a direct liaison exercise. One got mixed up in some pretty hectic ground activity, which proved to me beyond a shadow of a doubt that as far as McGill was concerned, I'd chosen the right element in which to go to war. I thought going to war on the ground was a much overrated pastime. It was very exciting.
Whereabouts were the 2nd New Zealand Division?
This was at the time of the City Rezeg and places like that. And in fact, the divisional headquarters was cut in half while I was with it.
This was November 41.
41, yes.
Operation Crusader.
That's right. And I finished up in Tobruk with half of the division, and the other half went back to Cairo, I think. But it was very exciting indeed. It was in pretty open sight stuff with 25 pounders and things like that.
Do any incidents stick out in your mind from
that? As you know, New Zealand is a very active rugby playing country. And in every small town, there's usually a rugby club known as City. And I was appointed by General Acta Mason, I suppose, to be the aircraft spotter for the division. So any time any aeroplanes came around, they always said, "What is that?" And the cry was, "Do they play for us or for City?" And by the time I decided that it had played for City, I couldn't find a split trench anywhere to get into. The other chaps had got there before me. It was quite fun.
What did you actually? How close did you come to the fighting, though?
A couple of hundred yards, I suppose. We woke up one morning, and it must have been 1,000 yards or so. And as the light came up, we saw some troops right in the near distance. They turned out to be Italians, but they had a lot of artillery, and they started brushing off at us, and naturally the fires returned. And the headquarters staff, the clerks and things, were summoned and told to pick up their muskets and form the rear defence of the headquarters, which was fairly close. I spent most of that day in a slit trench with popping in and out as required. After all, you worked in slit trenches, and got out when one was required to do anything and got back again. But we were shelled most of the day, and some of them bounced, some of them went off, and some didn't.
Who had control of the air at that time at City Rezeg?
I think the best thing way to describe that was a fairly free-flowing air battle. I don't think we could claim to have air superiority by any means, and I don't think the enemy could either. But the Huns were in there, of course, by that time, and you saw 109s and all that sort of stuff. And in fact, as we advanced, this was before City Rezeg, I got a signal from headquarters Middle East we're going to overrun an airfield. I think it was Al Adam, I'm not sure now. And the chaps back in Cairo were very interested to get their hands on a 109F, which was pretty new at that time. And I was invited to get onto the airfield as soon as I could. And if there was a 109F there, and if I could get it started, and if it had worked to fly the thing out. I didn't know much about 109Fs, as you can imagine. I was not disappointed to find there wasn't a 109F there anyway, because I felt pretty sure that if I'd got it off the ground, I would have been shot down anyway. Either by the troops who didn't like 109s or by their own fighter boys trying to increase their score. So happened, there wasn't one.
Did you go into Tobruk?
Yes, we went there. I went into Tobruk at that time. That was quite exciting. I had as a liaison officer, I had my own transport. It was a brand new Ford station wagon, a beautiful thing. But the Italians put a 75 shell down on the running board of it, fortunately, when I wasn't in it. But one of the brigades gave me one of the original Volkswagens as used by the Germans. They gave me that as a runabout. The only trouble is it had carburation trouble. And when it was decided that the Div had to cut and run the headquarters. I was to test the part that were going into Tobruk, and we were motoring along a road that the by moonlight, and the Huns had it ranged to a degree, and this damn thing broke down, and it kept stopping and starting. But I was rescued by New Zealanders in the Dodge. They threw me a line, sort of lifeboat fashion, and we took a couple of half hitches around the steering wheel, and we bounced the rest of the way into Tobruk along this road, accompanied by a few 88 millimeter shells from time to time.
What did you find in Tobruk?
I wasn't there very long. I found a couple of hurricane chaps. There were some hurricanes being operated from there that the opposition didn't know anything about. They'd go off and they were hidden in caves, and a couple of Australians were running. That was perfectly. I didn't see a lot, in fact, because I got myself onto an aeroplane pretty smartly and back to Cairo. My job had finished. I had a look down the harbour and the usual devastation, and the Navy were running destroyers in and out and that sort of thing, so we saw a few of them. I didn't get up into the outer defences of Tobruk. As I say, my job was virtually finished, so I tidied up what little was to be done, talking to the staff, and got myself on an aeroplane that was going back to Cairo.
What impression did General Freyberg make on you?
Magnificent.
In what way?
Again, like Slim, inherent leadership, inspiring direct confidence in everybody who he dealt with. It was really an amazing chap. I can't comment on his tactical ability, obviously, but he had all his troops with him all the way. There's no shadow of doubt about that. But I attended a conference a briefing that he held in the desert. He called in everybody from company commander upwards, and you could see, he could sense. I was sitting on the desert with these chaps, so there's a little aside there too. See, these people had been with him for a long time. They'd gone into Greece, and they'd had to get out of Greece with him. They'd had the debacle of Crete, and it got them out of there, and that sort of thing. And he was a tough trainer, and he trained them all up again, and at Helwan, south of Cairo, and he knew them all, and they knew him, and it was great stuff. I was naturally a member of his little headquarters mess, and that sort of thing.
What was that aside you were thinking of?
Yes. There was a very noisy day going on one day, and most of his communications were in the back of an armoured car, and the back doors would open and he'd get in there, and he's a big man, as you probably recall, and there he was with there was quite a lot of shelling going on. There was this great man standing up there talking into a handheld microphone with bangs going on everywhere, not taking cover at all, and he was talking to Willoughby Norrie, who was commander of the South African division. And their way of maintaining security, they talked to each other in Urdu, in plain language, in Urdu.
What was the morale in the division?
Very good, very good. It was very good indeed. I ran into one or two of my school friends, and I could talk to them, man and boy, sort of thing. I was acting wing commander under the greatest suspicion. I did mention this briefing we had in the desert, and this is true. It sounds almost apocryphal, but it's true. I sat down, Tony said, sit down, and I'll call for you at the appropriate time. Get up and tell the chaps what sort of support they're liable to get. And I sat down behind a chap, we're all squatting on the desert, and I was looking at the back of this bullet-shaped black head, and I thought, you know, I've seen that before somewhere. I sat for a minute, and I suddenly realised this major in front of me was my math teacher at the Hamilton Technical College, and I outranked him. How's that? Right out of the blue, like that.
What did you do once you got back to Cairo?
I went back on the staff for only for a matter of months. I thought I was going to get a squadron again, but while I was out with the division, so they had to give it to somebody else. So I said it's time I went back to, I got back to England and been out there about 4 years then. And so I came back to England.
In fact, in May of 1942, you were with squadron leader with 226
Yes,
squadron.
The intervening time is who I was getting back. We came back by sea around Cape and had engine trouble, went over to Trinidad, and by the time I got back to England, did a bit of conversion training onto other types of aeroplanes. It took that length of time, so by May I was back on on operations in England.
Can you tell me about this 226?
It was a day, mainly day light bomber squadron equipped with the North American, well, the Douglas Boston, a good aeroplane in those days. Tricycle undercarriage, powerful, fairly fast. And it was part of a well-known group, two group of the Royal Air Force, which was destined to become the light bomber group of the 2nd Tactical Air Force. And although at that stage we were still part of Bomber Command, very soon afterwards we moved through a reorganizational sequence into the 2nd Tactical Air Force. And the targets were in the Low Countries, and the fringe targets of West Germany. Preparatory, really, to the operations of the 2nd Tactical Air Force in support of the invasion and so forth.
What were these planes like to fly?
Very good, beautiful aeroplane. And it was fast for those days, and it was a good low-level aeroplane. I think perhaps the most spectacular low-level attack that we were mixed up in was the attack on the Phillips Works at Eindhoven. The whole of the group had a go at that, and it was quite reasonably satisfactory, done by day.
Can you describe it in detail as you remember it?
Yes. It was laid on as a multiple squadron low-level operation with the Boston's squadrons, the Ventura squadrons, and the very new Mosquito squadron following up. I was the flight commander leading the last flight of Boston's to go in. It was a very highly concentrated attack. And in the main, it was, I think, pretty successful. Whether we did the amount of damage that long-lasting damage, I think was hoped for, as a matter of opinion, I think. But the main object of attacking those Phillips radio works, it was believed at that time that they were producing a high proportion of the valves used by the German forces. The losses were reasonable. There was a bit of confusion on the way out, but I think it can be regarded as a pretty successful operation. But there's certain small things stick in one mind, because we were pretty good at low flying. We went really very low, and as we were going across the Low Countries, the old Dutchmen and that sort of thing we passed were waving to us and cheering us on and that sort of stuff. Rather good.
What time of day was it?
In the morning, we took off pretty early. My memory's terrible.
But evidently daylight.
Oh, it was all daylight, yes. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. On second thoughts, it might have been at midday. I have a feeling that it was done either very early or midday in the hope that there'd be relatively few workmen in the... works, because they were mainly Dutch anyway, and I think that was right. But that was the last, far as I recall it, full-scale low-level operation daylight done by the group. Many, many more spectacular ones were done later on by smaller numbers by the mosquito force, but that's another matter. And I wasn't concerned with that.
Do you remember the date of that attack?
No, I've got it somewhere. But,
or which month it was?
I can't remember. It was in 42. I can get it for you. Oh, wait.
Was it before or after the Dieppe raid?
Before, well before.
Well, the Dieppe raid was August. Do you remember your crew on that raid?
Oh, yes. There's a crew I had throughout my operations in England. I had a gunner, a Welshman, called Taffy Gubbins. And believe it or not, his name was Gubbins. And it was the one case when you really had the Gubbins in the back. And my navigator was a fellow called Donald Walsh, an Australian. And while we were on Boston's, as I think we spoke about earlier on, there was a three-place aeroplane with a navigator in the front, pilot slightly aft of him, and the gunner in the back. So the emblem we had on the side of the aeroplane was a boomerang. This wasn't a bad idea, the idea of throwing it and getting it back again. A Welsh dragon sat on the front, if you can imagine, the front tip of the boomerang, the kiwi in the middle, and the kangaroo, other way around, the kangaroo on the front, the kiwi in the middle, and the Welsh dragon at the back, rather an attractive
So you did that raid on Eindhoven the Vostok.
That's right.
Did the German Air Force come up against you?
There were some, as you can imagine, there's a fairly sizable gaggle of aeroplanes. I can't tell you how many there were in, but X number of squadrons involved at very close intervals going low level, and really low level. And there was some nibbling, certainly on the way out, of the chaps on the outside. But we had quite a lot of anti-aircraft fire over Eindhoven thereabout, and a certain but tactical routing on the way in avoided most of that, certain amount of anti-aircraft fire on the way out. But as far as we were concerned, our casualties were relatively low. The leader of the whole operation was actually in Boston, and he got hit, but he managed to get his airplane back on one engine. And of course, our own fighters were waiting to escort us from the enemy coast home. So it wasn't too bad from that point of view.
And you were based at a place called Swanton Morley?
Swanton Morley in Norfolk.
What kind of an airfield was that?
Grass airfield, funnily enough. It's still in operation. It's still going. It's the home of the technical engineering branch produce a lot of the technical instructions for airplanes. That's fine.
Then, fairly soon after this raid, you supported the famous Dieppe raid in August 19.
We had 2-6, as it was then, had an unusual role of smoke laying. The idea really was, I suppose, copied from the Navy, that the idea being to blank out the forces coming by sea from the direct observation by shore-based batteries and so forth. Our activities were confined to smoke, either dropping canisters of phosphorus compounds, which produce a lot of smoke, or laying smoke curtains from smoke containers we carried in our bomb bays.
Which did you do?
Both, in fact. First thing in the morning, we were supposed to drop some of these containers on one of the batteries just on the western side of the beach at Dieppe. And we all went in. It was a pre-dawn takeoff, but we went in very low, had individual targets, and I just about got mine. I had to let the stuff off a bit early because the Marines were obviously scaling the cliffs just below this battery, and they didn't like an aeroplane coming in low, so they had a shot at me and set my bomb load on fire. So we had to get rid of that just a little bit short of our target, but I think we got most of it on the spot.
This was a shot from our own commandos.
Well, that's war. When there's
a rifle shot?
No, 20mm stuff. I was all right. They damaged the bottom of the airplane, but then the starboard engine nacelle got one or two, but we were not hurt.
Was the smuggling successful then?
I think so, yes. The rest of it was. And then later in the day, we were invited, as withdrawal took place, to lay smoke right along the beaches as the Navy were pulling out. And that was fairly exciting. We went in right under the cliff and along the... Do you know Dieppe? Right along the beach front, in fact, at about from 100 feet. I suppose I was about 100 feet. A chap below me and a couple above, there was a formation of about 5 airplanes. And almost looking down the barrels of the chaps who were shooting at it. We're lucky. We only lost one out of that outfit. But the idea was to screen the beachhead while the Navy was still withdrawing seaward.
Any other memories from Dieppe?
No, I think not really, because when you're doing a precise job like that, you're concentrating so fully on your flying and where you are actually flying, and then it's a matter of getting the hell out of it, getting down on the further on the water if you can, and getting it going home, avoiding the ships at sea if you possibly could. And, I have a certain amount of sympathy for the Navy, because if you go to see an airplane coming at you bloody fast, right on the sea, your identification's got to be pretty good and pretty sure. And
we've got your logbook for your entry for the Dieppe raid. Can you read out what you've got there?
Yes, surely. At the end of the day, when we'd gone back to our base, where we operated from a forward base in the south of England, and we had pretty heavy aircraft casualties in the Dieppe thing. Our personnel casualties were disproportionately less, fortunately. I think we took 12 airplanes down from the squadron the next, and we were able to fly 3 of them back immediately after the show. But when we got back to base that evening, we received a signal from headquarters, and it read this. The following message received from the AC 11 group begins, "I cannot thank you enough for the wholehearted cooperation of your squadrons and hope you will convey my congratulations to them on a very fine performance." Signed, Lee Mallory. And now it goes on from the group headquarters itself, from 11 group. "I wish to add my congratulations on a text pressed